It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A historian of public schooling in the U.S. turned education advocate visited the state over the weekend. She joined in an event celebrating the teacher strike of 2018.
I wanted to be here to thank the teachers because what they did was incredibly courageous. They started a wave of strikes saying, we demand dignity, we demand respect.
We'll have that conversation in just a few moments. This is West Virginia Morning. A battle over the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is headed to the U.S. Supreme Court this morning. Oral arguments are scheduled in a case over a key permit that would let the natural gas pipeline cross under the Appalachian Trail. Brittany Patterson reports.
In December 2018, a federal appeals court ruled that the U.S. Forest Service improperly granted the 600-mile pipeline a permit to cross under the Appalachian Trail, a popular 2,200-mile hiking route that goes from Georgia to Maine. The ruling could have big impacts for the route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which begins in West Virginia and crosses through Virginia and North Carolina. Now, the case will be heard in front of the High Court. Both the pipeline supporters and opponents say they are cautiously optimistic.
We think that the Fourth Circuit clearly erred.
That's West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, a Republican, speaking at a recent press conference at the Capitol in Charleston. Morrissey led a group of 18 state attorneys general who filed an amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to overturn the lower court's ruling.
You cannot set up literally an impenetrable federal barrier to economic development, not only under our Constitution or our law, but under the statutes, the Mineral Leasing Act.
The barrier he's talking about is the Appalachian Trail. Pipeline spokesperson Ann Nallo says more than 50 other pipelines cross under the Appalachian Trail.
So where the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is currently routed is underneath a 1/10 of a mile stretch about 600 feet below the surface of the Appalachian Trail.
She says if the lower court's ruling is upheld, that would upend decades of precedent and permits.
If it's now going to be understood that it's National Park Service land where a pipeline can't cross without congressional approval, that essentially turns it into a 2,200-mile barrier. So we don't think that Congress intended for these kinds of barriers to be put in place.
But environmental groups say this case is different. Greg Bupert is an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, one of the groups that will defend the lower court's decision.
Yes, to be sure, other pipelines cross the Appalachian Trail. What's different here is that the crossing is proposed on federal land. That's never been done before. There's never been a new right-of-way for a pipeline on federal land in the last 50 years.
Bupert says even if the Supreme Court sides with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in this case, officially called U.S. Forest Service versus Cowpasture River Preservation Association, the project's future is murky.
If you step back away from the Cowpasture case and the Appalachian Trail crossing issue, which I think is just a symptom of the route Dominion chose, I think this project has serious problems and obstacles ahead of it. You know, there is a bucket full of missing permits.
Several of the project's federal permits are in flux and other lawsuits are ongoing. Project developer Dominion Energy says the project has ballooned in cost to $8 billion. The Supreme Court is expected to hand down its ruling in May or June of this year. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
President Donald Trump has increased the federal share of costs to help West Virginia recover from floods that ravaged the state in June 2016. Governor Jim Justice's office said Friday that Trump approved his request to increase the federal share from 75% to 90% for public assistance projects. A recent award of $101.7 million in Federal Emergency Management Agency funds to rebuild two Nicholas County schools helped the state meet the threshold for a cost share increase, the governor's office said. Covered costs include emergency expenses, debris removal, and infrastructure repair. The increase falls under a major disaster declaration by former President Barack Obama in 2016 after the floods killed 23 people and damaged hundreds of buildings in the state. West Virginia School Superintendent Stephen Payne has stepped down from his post to take care of a family member with a serious medical issue. The State Board of Education held an emergency meeting Friday to accept the retirement of Payne and appoint his interim successor, Clayton Birch, who has been serving as associate superintendent. Earlier this month, Payne announced he would be leaving the position by June or sooner, depending on when his replacement was picked. In a letter to the school board Friday, Payne said he needed to retire immediately to devote his full attention to his ill family member. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:49. Cloudy skies today with a chance of rain, highs in the 40s and 50s. Rain tonight with lows in the 30s and 40s. Tomorrow, chance of rain continues with high temperatures in the 50s and low 60s. Support for the weather forecast is provided by Jaeger Airport CRW, now with flights to Orlando, Florida, MCO. More at JaegerAirport.com. Diane Ravitch is an author and public education historian turned education activist. She was in Charleston over the weekend to speak at the Red for Ed celebration on the second anniversary of the West Virginia teachers' strike. She spoke with Eric Douglas about the teachers' movement and her book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools.
Explain to me what makes you an expert in education and education reform.
I have a doctorate in the history of education, American education specifically. So I began my career in education by writing a history of the New York City public schools because that's where I was living. And since then, I've written about a dozen books. And in 1991, I went to work as Assistant Secretary of Education for the first President Bush. So I know Washington, having worked there for 2 years and stayed on a year at a think tank. And then I became very involved in conservative think tanks. And I worked in various conservative think tanks. I was an advocate for testing and for choice and for all of those things. And then about 2008, 2009, I became disillusioned with the things that I had been in support of.
And you make the point, though, that this is that both parties are to blame. This isn't
right.
This isn't Republican versus Democrat sort of thing. The last couple presidents have played a role
right.
in this.
President George H.W. Bush supported choice. He didn't get anywhere with it. He supported testing. He didn't get anywhere. And then President George W. Bush promoted something called No Child Left Behind, which required every school in America to test every child every year. And the reason for it was he said there had been a Texas miracle. And 20 years later, we know there was no Texas miracle, but we're continuing to do what he recommended based on what, in effect, was a hoax. Then President Obama came along, and he adopted the George W. Bush plan of No Child Left Behind, and he added something to it called Race to the Top, which was even worse than No Child Left Behind because it was very punitive, everything based on test scores. And I've become, I spent 7 years on the National Testing Board, and I've become a very strong critic of standardized testing. I don't think it's helping our children. I think that the more we test, the less that kids learn because there's less time given to instruction. And that leads me to why I wrote this book.
Go ahead and continue then. Why did you write this book?
Well, I'm in West Virginia today to celebrate the second anniversary of the West Virginia teacher strike. I wanted to be here to thank the teachers because what they did was incredibly courageous. They started a wave of strikes, teacher strikes, saying, we demand dignity. We demand respect. We demand to be treated as professionals. And their example started a wave of teacher strikes across the country. It spread from West Virginia to Oklahoma to Colorado to California to lots of other states. I don't think that wave of strikes is over, but it really gave hope and inspiration to teachers all over the country.
What brought us to this point?
Well, we've had at least 20 years since the passage of No Child Left Behind. And really, you could take it all the way back to the Reagan 1983 report saying that our schools are mired in mediocrity. We've had one or two generations of bashing teachers, demonizing teachers, and we're not spending enough on education. I mean, you will hear people say, oh, we're throwing money at education. Well, nobody in the school seems to be catching that money. It's going somewhere else, but it's not in the classroom. When you hear, as I have, and see classes of 35 kids, you know that this is not good for kids. When you see that there are schools that don't have a nurse, you know that that money is not being thrown at education. As a result of the West Virginia teacher strike, I think the whole national narrative about education changed.
Did the teachers in West Virginia accomplish what they set out to, and elsewhere, not just in West Virginia? Were they successful?
I think they were incredibly successful because what they did was that they unleashed a movement and they stood together for the first time in their lives, and they realized that they had power. And at any time in the future, if people are ignoring education, refusing to fund the schools, this could happen again, and it should happen again if the legislature continues to underfund the schools.
The legislature approved legislation to allow 3 charter schools over the next 3 or 4 years. Why not give it a try?
Why not give it a try as we've had 30 years of charter schools? So it's not like you're trying something that's never happened before. It's happened all over the country. If charter schools were the answer, if vouchers were the answer, we would be looking to Milwaukee and Detroit for the as models. Detroit, about half the kids in Detroit are in charter schools. It's the lowest performing city in the United States. In Milwaukee, there are 3 equal sectors in terms of numbers. They have vouchers, they have charters, and they have a shrinking public school system. The public school system in Milwaukee is overloaded with kids with disabilities because the charters and the vouchers don't want those kids.
So where do we go next? What's the next step in fixing education in the United States?
Well, I'd say the next step is that we need to have a commitment as a nation to, first of all, having a federal government that recognizes its limits. I would love to see the elimination of the federal mandate of standardized testing. And I'd also love to see all these billionaires who are leading the privatization movement come to grips with the fact that they've totally failed. I mean, we've spent, as a nation, they've spent, and our federal government has spent, billions of dollars opening charter schools. The federal government alone has spent $4 billion starting charter schools. Almost 40% of the ones they've opened have either never opened, are closed right after they open. And in Florida, where there are about 650 charter schools, they have as many charter schools closing every year as they do opening. So this is like running schools like a business, and you put your kids there if the charter school will take them, and you may show up one day in January and find a note on the door saying, "Sorry, we closed."
That was Diane Ravitch speaking with Eric Douglas. Ravitch is a historian, an education activist, and author who was visiting the state over the weekend to celebrate the 2nd anniversary of West Virginia's teacher strike. Her most recent book, Slaying Goliath, is about massive private funding in the educational reform movement that began in the Bush era and the teachers' movements that have spread across the country in its wake. Visit our website at wvpublic.org for more of this interview. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director and producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.